Okay.
And we're back to Bibliosynensis.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing? Welcome, Hauntiers and Bibliophiles.
So, today we are going through...
We are actually following up the previous episode. We talked about...
Book collecting.
Yes. So, now we're going to talk about... I guess the reasons why you book collect or where to find books.
Yes, this is pertaining to that question we had on the last episode where she asked me what types of collectors are there and can you tell the difference between, you know, each collector? And I only mentioned two. The last one I didn't actually particularly get into, but in this episode I could definitely help you guys out with meeting that criteria, which is... the rare book collecting, the treasure hunters.
Oh, okay.
Being that, before we begin, what are we drinking today?
Oh, okay. So today we are drinking Everglen. And Everglen is actually one of my favorites. And I thought it would be appropriate for this podcast because it's kind of a little treasure of mine.
Mm.
The first tea I ever drank that was like a flavored tea that got me hooked on this whole journey of tea was actually an apricot black tea. And I've always loved it because it just gives me such nostalgia. When I was growing up, my treehouse was actually built in an apricot tree. So okay. It reminds me of home. And I've added some like other cozy elements to it. Like it has elderflower and ginger in it. So it kind of reminds me of just sun-drenched fields, which is very Californian, which is where we are.
Yeah.
Warm, you know, just that like warm feeling. It's a very bright and airy tea. And I also made sure to make it a decaf.
Which is the irony, because it's a black tea.
Yes, so it's a decaf black tea, but I made it because I can't think of anything better than cozying up at night to a really good black tea with milk.
Mm.
Your favorite, I guess, milk of choice.
Yes.
And, I mean, I just think it's such a tradition to just be cozied in your jammies. And big red bedtime stories. And I wanted something that kids could have. So it has the burst of flavors. It has a very strong, like, decaf black note, but also very strong, like, apricot and ginger and a little bit of elderflower note. But it holds its weight with tea and or with milk and sugar quite well. And it's the perfect evening, long read, bedtime story kind of tea. And it just reminds me of home. So I called it Everglen because it's for all imaginary or non-imaginary places that you want to call home.
Okay, so it's like an escape.
It's an escape tea.
Yes. And the lovely thing is, I slightly can't take milk. Mm-hmm. I can't exactly say I'm lactose intolerant, per se. But because of tea, I've been able to actually drink it. I'm not sure if it's just because, you know, of the milk that we have here in the U.S.
I remember that when we first started dating, we actually went to an organic ice cream shop and you almost threw up because of the smell.
Yeah.
But...
and as because it's opposed to my experience back when I was a kid in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for some reason, I was able to drink milk there. No problem. Mm. No problem. But I guess it feels like a super milk here. Like...
it's really dense?
It's dense. It's, I don't know. There's something about cow's milk that just is immensely, like, hyper milkish.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure how to put it. Interesting fact for everyone out there, most Filipinos apparently drink goat's milk, right?
If we can.
If you get it.
Milk is actually expensive.
Mm.
So the minute that you're drinking milk and you have like a taste for milk, they already know that you're rich.
Hmm.
They know you're rich. Or rather that you have to be a foreigner of some sort. Like
it's kind of just gourmet.
Yeah. I mean, like my parents were working here in the U.S. already. So obviously they could afford things. You know, when I was a kid there. But it was just, I don't know, like, it was a strange thing. Like, over there, it was like, it's like a treat over there. Mm-hmm. You know, you go right ahead and savor something like, I guess, a chocolate spoon here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody gets to have one. Not everybody even, you know, enjoys a chocolate spoon, where it's literally a spoon filled with chocolate and you just use it to stir on something. You know, it gets a little expensive to buy too many of those.
Well, I bet it's chocolate dip spoons.
Yeah, right?
I mean, people give those away as Christmas gifts here, so.
Exactly. So it's kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have it too much.
So, anyways, I mean, let's get into the subject of rare book collecting. I actually have two articles. They don't have to do with rare book collecting. They're a little more on the down-to-earth perspective of how and, like, where to collect books.
Yeah, so basically this is exactly what we were talking about. Treasure hunting.
Treasure hunting, but for, I guess, the layman's perspective.
For everyone that is acquiring a taste.
Yeah, because this podcast is to help people just, you know, get into reading and realize it's not all that intimidating. So, but let's talk about rare books. Let's talk about those kind of collectors from your experience. I mean, we touch a little bit on it last episode because we talked about, you know, the articles. We talked about, you know, what's collectible, like what's worth money and what isn't. And we were even talking about that Great Gatsby auction with the signed first edition.
Oh, yeah.
And how that was like thousands and oodles of dollars.
Yeah.
but I mean, what have you witnessed when it comes down to those rare book hunters?
A good seller has good buyers. So in order to actually prosper in treasure hunting for these books, mm-hmm. you have to know your buyers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of these books, you'll probably never hear any of their titles, ever. And it's only because, you know, it's important to certain generations that it actually affects. The older they are, the more obscure the book becomes. Mm-hmm. And people will pay thousands of dollars to the treasure hunter to actually find these books. And it's not that they're too hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nobody is alive long enough to actually pass it on to a treasure hunter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so there's two things that come to my mind.
Okay.
So the first thing is one of my first jobs straight out of college, or I should say it was my internship, was working for a theater.
Mm-hmm.
I actually worked for the Falcon Theater, and I helped with their press. And we were doing a play about books, so I was actually on task to go from bookstore to bookstore and drop off flyers. And I just remember this tiny little bookstore. It was in a cafe. It's not there anymore, unfortunately. I still go to that cafe. It's the Aroma Cafe in Burbank. But unfortunately, they had it's gone, but they had this little nook of a bookstore. And I guess the owner was, like, really into rare books or collectible books because it was just all these old world books. Like, most of them were, like, hymn books from, like, you know, old churches in France or just, like, really richly aesthetic books. And it was just, I mean, I can't imagine anyone saying, hey, I want a hymn book from, like, 1700s Paris. But,
yeah,
you know, I guess if you're that kind of collector. And then the second thing I would like to bring up is one of my favorite books, which is The 13th Tale. I believe it's by Diane Setterfield. Amazing read, by the way. I'll totally recommend that in our list. But it actually starts out with the protagonist, who's, like, going to become an authoress for this character. I won't go into detail.
Right.
But it takes place in a collectible used bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And the authoress says that practically nobody buys at a used bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
At her used bookstore in England. But her father would have one or two buyers a year. And they would ask for a specific book. And he would literally spend the whole year, if not years, scouring for these books. And she said, like, it was those little interactions that would literally pay for the entire shop for the year.
That sounds like Shadow of the Wind by Zaphod.
So, kind of. I mean, Zaphod also had the bookstore.
Yeah.
The Cemetery of Forgotten Books series, which, by the way, I think I have one more book in that little series.
Have you had Angel's Game?
I have done Angel's Game, and I've done Prisoner of Heaven, and I have done Shadows of the Wind. So those are the three, but I think there's one more. I think The Rose of Fire, I'm not sure if that's part of that trilogy.
Okay, a little trivia. Just as I mentioned last time, another Dumas book you could actually read is Prisoner of Heaven.
Oh, yes. Okay, so if you're looking for amazing Spanish authors,
mm-hmm.
Zaphod is by far my favorite. I know we talked about Marquez dabbling from time to time, but Zaphod has just... He is such an incredible read. Like, he is so... Like, you feel like you're literally tumbling back and forth. I guess the best way to explain it is imagine if you're reading a Hitchcock film set in Spain. That's the best way to explain it, because it's pretty cool. And it has a lot of, like, gothic references, and I don't know how to explain it. It's just, like, kind of like that thriller suspense.
Yeah.
And it's done so artfully that it literally feels like you're reading a Hitchcock film.
Okay.
It's like that same vibe you get.
So you're telling me like two books have actually mentioned about used bookstores having treasure hunters.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I was actually, so since you brought up Zaphod, I was thinking about Shadows of the Wind, one of the things that the father does for, I believe it was Daniel is the protagonist for that, is he gives him a pen, which he apparently acquired, and it's supposedly, it's not Dumas, it's the guy who wrote Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Ooh, can't remember.
Is it? You want to look it up?
No, must look. Oh my god.
It's like always, it's the guy who wrote Les Mis.
Yeah, I just never remember the author's name.
It's Victor, isn't it?
Let me, hold on.
Okay.
Hunchback of Notre
Dame. I believe it's Victor Hugo.
And drum roll. What?
Wow, you have such a slow phone.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
It's Victor Hugo.
No, yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's a thing. Like,
it's a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these, you know, I guess, Spanish, European-style books, they tend to enjoy, like, a good, dark, you know, lifestyle in their books.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, they make it sound so romantic when it happens. I guess it's just the humor and the temper of, you know, how the world is, you know, for people in that side of the continent.
Right.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I like it.
Okay.
It's broody and moody.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, but 13th Tale is actually a British authoress, and I just think about that. I think about, like, when you started working at the bookstore, and just that there's going to be those few people that will pay anything at any cost for a specific thing. I mean, okay, confession time. What's the most you've... Have you ever bid on books? And if you did, what's the most...
Me?
Bidding? Expensive bid.
I have never bid on a book.
I have bid on a book.
I am too scared if I bid on a book. I will bankrupt us.
I know one of the most expensive books that you were looking for was that architecture book called White.
On the philosophy
of the color white.
That keeps fluctuating, actually, over the price. I mean, the first time I saw it, it was like, you know, $25. And then the following 3 months, it went up to $35. And then, you know, 1 year after, it went up to $300. It was just a ridiculous book. I mean, the whole point of White was it was an architect that used Buddhist practices to, you know, have you concentrate on the simplicity of your home. So if you were to actually create, you know, one particular spot on your wall that you wanted, like, a frame or a photo, since the entire, like, structure is white, he would actually explain in an essayic form that it is a focal point for you. It's kind of weird. My dad used to say this to my mom because my mom and dad kind of grew up differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my mom had to, you know, sell cigarettes in the slums just to actually get to where she is.
Mm-hmm.
My father, on the other hand, actually had a rich family, which, ironically, she knew how to work. He didn't.
And because they had a business.
Yeah, wasn't it? Exactly.
Interesting.
But he always had to tell her to calm down because she would be so high strung that she just couldn't help but, you know, get mad sometimes. Sometimes it wasn't for anything at all. So he went ahead and actually explained to her, if you take a white piece of paper, it's just a white piece of paper. You can't really judge anything, right? Now, you put a dot on that piece of paper, that's all you can see. You completely forget the entire white sheet of paper, and you concentrate on that dot. And suddenly, the dot is the paper to you. You know? You'll just say, oh, it's this dot. And you can't keep concentrating on that dot. You have to actually understand that the rest of the paper is still in your hand. And that's important. Because without that paper, you wouldn't be holding anything.
Interesting. Okay.
But that is what White is all about. I have to find the author.
We'll put it in our recommendations.
Yes, we will.
But yeah, last time we checked it, I'm sure the value has gone down a little bit, but wasn't it like somewhere around $800?
At one point, yes. Like, it was just ridiculous. I guess the guy, you know, got famous in academia. And once a book becomes, you know, academic, it gets sought after and it will be, like, you know, purchased by students left and right. All thanks to just, you know, the fact that you go to college to make money someday. So obviously the books that they're selling is worth money. But nevertheless, yeah, it was kind of funny because me working at a publishing company that does nothing, it caters to no one but, you know, the construction industry. I thought I could actually get it for cheap, you know? I wanted that book. And I was like, this is the perfect place to get it, right? This is the perfect place to get it. They look it up, and they're like, one, it's not in our inventory. I'm like, okay, that's fine. Can we order it? Ah, that gets us to the second part. It's out of print. And I'm like, what? Okay, what does that mean? And to them, they're like, in their heads, I'm asking for the impossible. You know, if they ordered it from the publishing company, would they even have it still? You know, or did another publishing company get it? Or is it out up in the air and the author is probably holding the copyrights to himself? I don't know. And the only answer they gave me was, we can only give you store discount and you have to pay full price for the book.
Wow.
And I'm like, what does that mean? Like, it means we can't order it in bulk.
It would have to be one.
It would be one book.
That's great.
No, it's not great. You get a discount. Publishing companies get a discount from the manufacturing companies to order in bulk. So, yes, you may be paying $6.99 for your book someday. But it took them about $30,000 or $15,000 to get that book to cost that much for you to buy.
Okay, so the value goes up when there's less of it.
Yes.
Supply and demand.
Yes, especially when the demand is there. Because the problem that I had was that the demand was no longer there for that book when I asked my publishing company to do it. And they're like, again, it's not in print anymore. They're not printing it anymore. And two, I don't think anyone else is actually buying this anymore. So the price went down. And they're like, you may as well just buy it at Amazon. And I'm like, but that doesn't actually support the author. You know, the cut that Amazon gives you.
We'll go into that a
Oh my
different
God.
time.
It was terrible. It was heartbreaking. I did not know what to do.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting like subject all in
Oh,
itself
itself.
for a different episode. So,
Exactly.
well, tell me, what's a typical collector transaction when you are working at the bookstore? Like, how does it go about? Do they call your boss? Did they give them a list? Or is it like if ever you happen to and there's a collector section? I mean, what does that look like?
It literally looks like a regular guy comes up to the storefront and says, I need this book. And I tell them, we don't have this book. In fact, I can't even find it on Amazon. And they look at me and said, I need the book. Here's my number. Let me know when you have it.
Interesting.
And then I go right ahead and call my boss and I tell him that. And he's like, I'll look in our inventory, but if not, I think I know who may know somebody with that book.
So let's basically break this down. So I'm a book collector.
Right.
I want this specific book for whatever reason, we don't know, but I know.
Right.
You go in, I talk to you. How many hands do you think that book passes through? Or how many phone calls do you think from book, like from bookstore to bookstore? I mean, do bookstores do that? They do a call in?
They usually do because you don't get these books in warehouses. You don't get these books at bookstores. You get these books at warehouses. And the reason why, the reason why I was intrigued by the book company I was a part of, was the next job for me was I was going to learn how to take care of old books. Like I had to wear white gloves,
The kid gloves,
the
yeah.
kit, yeah, the kit gloves. I had to put it on a table where it has a platform that only opens the book like 90 degrees. And I had to learn how to inspect and I had to learn how to preserve. Now, if you know anything about preserving old books, this is what book doctors were all about. They knew how to take care, they knew how to restore a leather bound, they knew how to restore silk and cotton and every type of book that you could possibly make. And they would restore it. In fact, if they could actually find I guess the print house that would be alive, usually they're like in Europe, you know, somewhere in France, somewhere in Germany or
I have
somewhere.
seen only in my lifetime here in California, I think I've only seen two book doctors
Yeah.
traveling. I think I've seen, no, I've seen three. I think there was one in Frisco, one in Beverly Hills. There was one that was specifically for binding like law books in Glendale. I
Yeah.
don't even think they're around anymore,
They're around. They're around.
but
It's small, but
it's
they're
very
around.
specific. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know like English marbling, if you guys have actually
Oh,
seen
water
it.
marbling.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's very rare. Like, I'm surprised that we don't have it, you know? You find it in all these old, I guess, 1970s books, and you'd swear, like, oh, we used to do this. We used to have this all the time. Why don't we have it now? Literally, I think there's like, I don't know, like one or two places that still practices marbling, and it's hard.
That reminds me of, I'm just gonna bring it up. Remember my obsession with Italian cloth paper?
Yeah.
So, a little backstory on that. We were playing Taurus, and I think we were in Vegas.
We were in Vegas.
We were at the Venetian, and there was just this little, like, shop, and I didn't even think of it. But they had, like, a sketchbook. And I just wanted a sketchbook, so I grabbed it, paid for it. I don't even think it was significantly that expensive.
Oh, it was.
Was it?
Oh, it was. You just weren't looking.
I just wasn't looking.
I paid $35 for that sketchbook.
Okay, well then.
It was amazing.
Anyways, so I got this sketchbook, and I swear to everything, it is still my favorite sketchbook. It has, you can just feel it. It's a cross between like a linen paper of sorts, like a cloth paper. And just the way it takes ink is so smooth. And any ink, like ballpoint, you name it, like it just glides across the paper. So calligraphy, everything.
Using duck feather on that one.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I loved that sketchbook. And I've honestly been on a constant pursuit for it, and I cannot for the life of me find that consistency in a paper ever again. I mean, the closest thing I've gotten to was maybe like a really fine quality, like fine milled, what would you call it? Like a watercolor, like a really high end watercolor paper, mm-hmm. hybrided with like a marker paper.
Yeah.
But it's cloth. So I don't know. If anyone knows what I'm talking about, email us.
And a little tangent for everybody to know, Steph is actually like, she loves to play with quill. She loves to play with, you know, fountain pens.
I'm a very old medium sort of person.
I personally am like sick of fountain pens because that's all they teach you when you were like in, you know, grade school in the Philippines. Oof. Those things like popped on me every day.
You know, for all of you returning haunteers out there, if you've purchased from Two Spectral, you know that I handwrite the letters. I always do a thank you card. And I have recently been picking up calligraphy again, just simply because, I mean, who doesn't want a hand cursive written letter?
But to actually get back into the process of selling these rare books...
Mm-hmm.
They have to come to the warehouse,
mm-hmm.
and they have to actually see if it's the actual book that they want. Again, I've mentioned in the last episode, Julia Child published two books, mm-hmm. you know, first off with, you know, her two cohorts. And
I know, it's like Simone and then one other
woman. Yeah, and then there's the other one that she published by herself. A lot of times, people are looking for the one with Simone and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to find, to be honest. But if you could get both, ooh, the price goes from like, you know, goes from like 100 to like 500. And it really depends on the buyer. And the thing is, we do like silent auctions. So obviously, you give us your price, but we won't tell you who else gave the other price. And we won't even let you know sometimes that somebody else is buying it. We'll just let you know that we'll consider it, and if we actually want to continue, then we'll go right ahead and contact you.
So I actually know a little bit of history on that book, so maybe I can go through what I can remember and tell me maybe that, like, if that's the reason why that book is so rare or why it's so collectible. But I have read both Julie and Julia as well as My Life in France by Julia Child. Both are really entertaining reads in their own right. But if you've read My Life in France, a good chunk of the book is about her going back and forth in the process of writing the book and how she got it published. And I believe it was Knopf Publishing that took it. And okay. It was a chance. It was like a complete risk book for them because there was never an extensive guide on French cooking for Americans. And it wasn't even like a thought. Think about it. They were coming out of that era of like Escoffier and the Ritz-Carlton and that like 1920s kind of era. And then the war happened and then people were more domesticated around the 50s. People were thinking of at home, housewife cooking, yada yada. Like exactly. That homesteading. And I'm sure if you know anything about book collecting, those are actually really popular. We were talking about that in the article. Like any, like how to be a good housewife or cleaning or cooking back then. But that all-Americanness was sort of what was wanted. So to go on a limb and try to bring in French cuisine for an American audience was a big risk. And so I don't know if they made like a lot of copies, but it took a while for that book to get popular. And eventually the reason why it got popular was because of Julia Child's cooking show. And that's why she created the second one. And it's not even like useful. I mean, I don't want to say that. I mean, I love French cooking, but like I can tell you, like after I got that book, I was curious, so I got my own French cookbook. And till this day, I make some of those recipes, but most of them, like, nobody needs to know how to put a duck in a duck press, or nobody needs to know how to make, like, oodles and oodles of these buttery dishes that take hours and days to prepare, right? Lobster, I mean,
yeah.
Who's gonna do that? Even in American cooking, period, like for the 50s, you know, nobody's gonna sit there and slave away at an 8-hour prep meal. But that's what made it so unique, is it was really a technique book. Okay. And the first one is more of a technique book, whereas the second one is more of a follow through with those techniques.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So does that, I mean, any of that ring a bell as to why it's so collectible?
I think it's because some of the people that we dealt with those books may have been chefs. And chefs actually, they want to be on top of their game. They have to be, you know? It's they rely on reviews, they rely on their sous chef, they rely on the restaurant's repertoire to actually build their career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of these chefs, like, yeah, they stay in their restaurants, like, forever sometimes, but they do actually get commission to make certain dishes by really rich people, sometimes even at weddings, and if they could actually prove that they could make that dish, people will pay for it. So obviously these old recipe books, they're...
They kind of need them.
They need them.
For the technique. I mean, especially since I mentioned the first one's about technique and how to create such things.
Exactly.
That's interesting. Because the more I read about historic entertainment... I mean, I was just talking about Ritz and Escoffier, which was actually a read I did this year for 2020. Loved it. I devoured it in like a week. It was phenomenal.
Is that the one with the
Savoy? Yes. So it's the history of the two men who created the Ritz-Carlton,
right,
basically, and how they worked for the Savoy and how they created entertainment, basically a whole culture, and why they wanted to move forward with the Ritz-Carlton and why the Ritz-Carlton is what we know now. One of the things that was so fascinating was Escoffier was the head chef, and he would entertain the guests by making dishes after them. Like, oh. A lot of people don't know this, but the peach Melba was actually created after an actress, or I believe it was a singer, who was Melba. So he made it in honor of her, and he would use, like, these very specific French techniques to impress and wow the guests. And one thing he was infamous for is his poached fruits and, like, really delicate jellies and such, and that's where the peach Melba came from.
Makes sense.
The more I study about history, the more I understand, like, just foods and technique and how they kind of are landmarks.
Okay.
And they also talk about the time. I mean, Fun little fact, if nobody knows about it, fettuccine Alfredo is not a traditional Italian dish, even though we all love it, right?
Yeah.
At first I thought, like, I heard rumors that it was created for a pregnant woman. I mean, and that's why it's so creamy and rich. I don't know if that's true, but I know that white sauces became trendy in the 20s because it was all about excess and decadence. People were traveling. So a lot of, like, foreigners were going to Italy and they wanted the Italian experience, but they also wanted that excess. And tomato sauce was obviously not going to do it. So you get these gorgeous, white, rich sauces, and that's actually where it came from.
Okay.
Well, at least I know where it hit its popularity. Was during around roughly the flapper time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm on a tangent here, but...
Huzzah. So, I guess when it all comes down to it, these rare books are only demanded if there's a buyer. And these buyers are actually what makes these books worth anything. You don't know how many books we actually have in the world and how many we actually ignore just because nobody sees value in them. Like, I guess a good one that I didn't find value in for, like, the longest time was, okay, I guess old medieval poetry. Nobody thinks about that, you know? Like, you think English poetry, that has, like, just history in itself because you love that. You love that stuff. And ordeal was, I was getting into Highwaymen at one point, and I started looking into Dick Turpin. I started to look up all these fun little things that happened left and right.
So on that note, I just want to say it is incredibly hard to find the subject of Highwaymen. I don't know why.
That is so awkward.
Because I mentioned prior, Georgette Hayes, the reason why I went to read her books,
yeah,
is because she did have Highwaymen, and it was so incredibly wonderful to finally find a readable novel with Highwaymen in it, which you would think
would be
more of a thing. But I think during that era, it was such a degenerate thing to do that you don't really get much on the matter of Highwaymen.
Well, there wasn't really much you could, you know, fine, because they would literally just have posters and wanted ads, and you would have to go by, like, what the villagers actually would say or what they would write. I mean, Dick Turpin himself wasn't really that great unless you actually go by, like, the lore that people would talk about. You know, like, he was an ignorant guy that, you know, got caught once, and you know, he got caught because he actually was hiding at a barn, and some guy was, like, telling him, hey, you can't stay here. And he's like, I'm just trying to pass by. If you could just kind of help me out, I don't know how to write. The guy teaches him how to write. He goes right ahead and writes a letter. And then he's like, wait, what did you write about? You're Dick Turpin? And he gets jailed. That's it. That is it. Has, like, all of these amazing adventures that they write about him, and, you know, how he was just, like, this amazing lawman. Like, that was it. And if anything, I feel like I'm actually more in love with the stories about Plunkett and MacLean.
I actually am reading the books for Plunkett and MacLean. I have, like, I believe the first book on my reading list, like, before Plunkett and MacLean. Like, it's the same universe.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll look it up. But
either way, that, I guess, I don't want to actually stay on this topic for too long. Like, I basically used that to kind of find my way into François Villon. You know, he's a medieval poet, and he was a thief. Mm-hmm. And the thing was, it wasn't like he was without, you know, he wasn't really that poor. And he had patrons. Like, they loved his poetry so much that every time he went to jail, they would pay for his bail. And he would be out. And he continues stealing.
That's cool.
Like, a thief had a patron, people.
It's like the early version of Patreon.
Yeah. So, you don't think these things were important. Mm-hmm. But I guess this is where, like, you become more than just a reader, and then you become a historian. And historians, there's a saying in the community, never believe a historian. Mm-hmm. Because they will always take...
the side of the other.
Yeah, they'll take a side.
Oh, yeah.
They never, you know, it's not every day that you get to actually hear both sides and get a dry cut of what was actually happening. Mm-hmm. Anyways,
so was that your point?
My point is that people don't find worth in a lot of books. Mm-hmm. So this is why, I guess, when you go to Barnes & Noble, you see the same exact 25 books. You'll always...
Oh my goodness, yeah. Don't get me started.
I know, you'll always find Frankenstein. You'll always find, you know, Jane Austen. You'll always find, I don't know, like...
Oh, the Harry Potter section. Yeah. It's literally turned into a toy store.
Well, that makes sense, because Harry Potter in itself is still relevant now.
Right, but I'm just saying, it's like... I see more non-Harry Potter script book, like, just book, mm-hmm. and more
of
paraphernalia.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, more power to you, Rowling.
Yeah.
Anyways, so, we were talking about it's all in the eyes of the beholder. So, I think that's a good segue into my two articles.
All right.
Okay. So, I have two articles here. One of them is how to grow your home library. And the other one is how to curate that library. Or right. Suggestions to curate. So I figured we'd go through the list of 7 ways to grow your home library on a budget. I found this article on bookshark.com. Which is apparently a homeschooling resource website. I mean, I was homeschooled for a chunk of my educational time, and my library was an imminent resource. It was so prominent, I should say. It was a real prominent part of my education.
Right.
When people had their little book backpacks, I actually had crates in my room filled with books, and I miss those days so much. So let's dive into that, and let's see. Okay. So starting at number 1, they suggest start by borrowing at the public library.
I agree.
Because books are ever-changing, and it helps you pick out your taste.
Okay, that's a coin with 2 sides. Mm-hmm. On one side, yes, I would have never learned that each library actually is curated. Like, the NoHo library actually had a section for martial arts. And I would have never known, you know, all these different exotic martial arts, like capoeira, or, Krav Maga. Mm-hmm. Ever existed without that library. And it was interesting because when I was growing up, dragons and medieval stuff was pretty, like, prominent, even in movies. You know, I went for that. That was actually my first book. But understand, your libraries are curated. Yes, it may help you explore, but it is dependent on the curation of that library. I mean, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, my childhood library was actually not destroyed, but they took it down and then they revamped it. Like, I'm just impressed with the large, believe it or not, the children's section and how it has its own wing. And I was just amazed to see what kind of books were there. Everything else I can't really agree with. Oh my goodness. The poetry section was just... I don't want to say garbage, but it was just not what it should have been. Yeah. But, yeah, I noticed. I totally get that.
Okay.
So the second thing they suggest is A simple way to refresh your library at no cost is to swap with your friends.
If you have friends that actually read.
See, that's... I have a problem where nobody gives my books back.
That is a real problem for everybody.
And that's a whole different episode, I think.
Yeah.
But, I don't think I think I've only exchanged books with people like 2-3 times in my life. I don't see that done very often anymore.
Well, you can't, because people are kleptomaniacs. Okay? Like, who would want to actually pay $25 for a really good hardback cover nowadays? No one. All right? And if you have, kudos to you. You've just actually supported an author.
It's so funny because I'm literally staring at my Bedore collection and I am missing... Okay, I'm not missing anything, but the one... Like, the first book is not a hardcover because you had to go buy it.
Yeah.
At Barnes & Noble's for me to get it signed by Bedore because the person that I lent it to hadn't returned it in 2 years.
Yes. It was that good.
And... It sucked, because that was, like, a first edition hardcover.
Oh, God.
But that's funny.
But nevertheless, you know, I disagree with that.
I would disagree with that, too.
Because...
I think it's good to swap titles, but, you know, my friends, that is what Goodreads is for. So,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Next one.
Give books as gifts.
I like giving books as gifts. Because people don't like to actually explore over, I guess, what might be a book that they might enjoy someday. Because change is uncomfortable. So obviously, if they're a romantic reader, they'll just go for the next Harlequin book. But no one would ever suspect that a romantic, you know, reader might actually like some sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, you don't realize how the concept of heroism mm-hmm. in romance books actually collides so well with, I guess, philosophical, sympathetic, you know, I guess, empathetic
mm-hmm.
themes, you know, just really touches, you know, in the heart.
So my first non-required novel was actually a gift on my 13th birthday. And I remember it because I was in the middle of changing schools and my birthday blew because nobody wanted to come to my birthday. And I had like 2 awkward friends come that I had just known for a few months. And we had a slumber party. I mean, I think, past stuff, that was a dumb idea to plan a slumber party on a 13th birthday when you were like swapping schools, girl. Not the greatest idea. Nobody really wants to sleep over at the new girl's house they've known a few months. But anyways, the few that braved it, thank you. Because one of my gifts was actually a novel and it was Redwall.
Oh.
And Redwall was my first, like, novel, not, like, you know, school-required novel.
Right.
And I still treasure it. So...
Lovely.
Even till now, I look for that cover specifically because it reminds me of my childhood and that tapestry art print version.
Yeah, that actually is a huge drive for a lot of people when they collect certain books.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the first illustration usually is like coveted. I know a lot of 1960s, 1970s books, they have, you know, nothing but those types of art. But the minute that they are republished, for some reason, that artist disappears. You know?
Interesting.
And people don't know where to follow that artist, so they collect those books.
Yeah, so specifically with the Redwall series, if people don't know, the Brian Jacobs series is about, like, I guess medieval fantasy, but with, like, furry, cute woodland creatures.
Yeah.
And most of the protagonists are all mice. But they used to have these gorgeous Celtic tapestries with kind of, like, a pictorial narrative on the covers of each book. And that's the one I grew up with. But now, I mean, the art's still pretty good. They have, like, I guess just semi-realistic illustrations of the characters. But it's just not that whimsical, you know, like, I guess aesthetic.
It felt cozy, I guess.
Not really just cozy, but almost like folk tale legendary. Yeah. It had that storybook, like, folktale vibe. So, but I look for the, when I go looking for Jacob's books to add to my collection, if I see one of those and I don't have it, I will take it. Right. Tangent. Okay. Shop library book sales.
Oof. All right. So this is the point where you guys actually get to learn how many people actually read in your community. Now, I've worked at a bookstore in Santa Anita.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think people would buy books there because, you know, obviously there's a big reading community there.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't buy books. They go back to their usual books. They don't explore. And then I actually worked in Sherman Oaks, you know, surprisingly. I wasn't expecting anyone to read there. It's the San Fernando Valley, guys. You know, like
people are too busy with other things.
Yeah, you know? And no, they read. They buy. Extremely. And surprisingly enough, like, when actors are done with their, you know, with their recordings or any of their filming, they run to bookstores. They run to places that we commonly don't, you know, think twice about. Because, you know, some of them, they have to cover their faces. They don't want to be showing that they're part of Glee. And they just came to a really popular venue and, you know.
Well, maybe it's because nobody really goes to bookstores unless they're having a Starbucks or...
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunate. I love that silly quote from Inkheart the movie where... Was it in Inkheart the movie? I think so. I know it's in the first couple of chapters, but, like, Maggie complains to Mo, like, why do we always go to bookstores that don't have coffee shops? Like, do you mean we're actually going to go to one where I can buy a hot chocolate or something? And I was like, you know, I never really thought about that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, next time you go to a famous bookstore or popular one, I guarantee you there are less people in the aisles and more people at the cafe. I mean, just take a look at it. I'm sure if you're a reader, you notice these things, but...
Yeah, I mean, if you guys ever want to know the experience of working at a bookstore, like a used bookstore,
mm-hmm.
if you've ever seen the sitcom Black Books...
Oh my god, I love that series!
It is heartbreaking because for like a good year and a half, that was my reality.
So, for those of you that actually do want to watch the series, I believe it's on Netflix, but it's like a 90s... bookstore joke sort of sitcom, right?
Yeah, it's this guy that actually has his own bookstore and he doesn't know how to do accounting. And all of a sudden this guy, you know, wants to quit his accounting job because he's miserable and comes in and says, I could take care of that. Let me be part of your bookstore. I want to be happy for a change. And he's like, oh, no. Oh, this is very hard, very hard. You know, you wouldn't even know how to price a book. And all of a sudden... Done. It's done. But the bookstore owner just still goes crazy on you. Like, oh, we're losing, you know, too much money. And then, like, a customer comes in and they're like, oh, yeah, you can have it for, like, you know, $6. And they're like, are you serious? This is the first edition. Okay, $5. Just get out. You know? Like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. It's so true. It's so true. It is a freaking nightmare. Like, you don't understand why they're even in business half the time. But you know what? For some reason, they know how to find the books. They know who these people are. And they know, you know, who the buyers could be. And their regular customers are usually not the people they want to care about.
Hmm.
You know, half the time, a used bookstore is actually just a farce. It's just their office to find you. That's it.
Interesting. So, next one. They said browse used bookstores, which we were just talking about. I don't even really go to mainstream bookstores unless I have to.
You don't go to mainstream bookstores for books. You go to mainstream bookstores to pick up chicks and get Starbucks.
Okay, so a guilty confession of mine is when people ask me what I want for Christmas, I'll request for mainstream books that you usually, or current books that you can't find at a used bookstore.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, shout out to my friend Candace who got me Not Your Beauty Mark, because like hell I was gonna buy that for myself. I've actually had my eye on it for years, and she just happened to think it was a good idea to get me, which, if those of you don't know, it's a coffee table book by Dita Von Teese on eccentric beauty and like vintage beauty and so on and so forth. So, really cool book. Can't wait to dive into it. It's literally sitting on my bedroom counter right now.
Nice.
Yeah.
I go to mainstream bookstores just to rebuy the same book again.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the new publication, the new lithium pages, and just all the prettiness that you get to have. And you get to have the chance to have an excuse to reread that book. You know? I mean, if anybody, you know, enjoys, like, marathoning their shows, I'm pretty sure you've rewatched your favorite show over and over. It's that same thing with books.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with Tolkien and Lewis fans, like, yeah. Yeah. But when it comes down to going to used bookstores, it's so sad that a lot of them just die off. And I kind of wonder, like, if it's just the age of the bookstore owner, or if it really was just that hard to actually keep the business going. I understand that the publishing company I'm working at now, it was originally just a bookstore, but because of hard times, they had to become a publishing company. And soon enough, they had to make software, etc. But that's how they stay alive. The bookstores, on the other hand, I would have to actually dig and actually have to find the ones that I love. And the sad thing is, they tend to die on me. A lot. And they have, like, the best sci-fi books. They have the best romance collections. They have, like, the best of the genres that you want. But you can never find them again because those bookstores die. So unless you know the author, you know the title, you know who published them first, you won't be able to actually see him again.
So, backstory on that, or a little loving story, is when Eugene went to college, he fell in love with Chinese history. And if anyone is a DBZ fan, they know that Dragon Ball Z is loosely based on the Monkey King.
Yeah.
So Eugene is actually a hardcore Monkey King fan. And there's so many different literature renditions of it.
Yeah, Shi Youji is,
yeah,
like, rewritten epically.
So
it is an epic.
I mean, there was a time where I was going to PCC, Pasadena Community College, and I don't know if anyone knows, but it's, like, heavily Chinese, like, populated.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this one used bookstore that was just Chinese literature. And it was just such a treat to go in and, like, find a really bad-ass, awesome copy of The Monkey King for Eugene. But, I mean, I say that story right now, and it almost sounds like a dream state because it doesn't exist, like, anymore. It's very rare to find specific genre-related bookstores, which, by the way, that's actually one thing we're going to put on the blog is unique bookstores for your treasure hunting that have to do with themes. We're going to put top five in LA County. Most of them actually have online stores. So I hope you check that blog post up.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't know if you guys have ever had this experience where, like, your heart breaks when that used bookstore goes away, and you swear that book should be found, and it's gone. It feels like a part of you is gone forever. Like, you know, maybe a finger sometimes, maybe an arm, but it just hurts.
Thank you so much for joining us on this conversation about treasure hunting for books. Due to the enthralling conversation, this podcast is actually going to be broken into two different episodes. So if you would like to continue to the next part of this discussion, you can check out bibliosinensis.com or refer to the next episode. We will see you then. Chin chin. Thank you.